Welcome. You're listening to the season 5 of the Young Changemakers podcast. This is a Global Changemakers production. If you would like to know more about the programs and the resources available for you, go check global-changemakers.net.
So, Anoka, thank you so much for joining us in the Young Changemakers podcast. You have been very prominent in the environmental activism for a long time, and we're very excited to hear your story, to hear from you, to hear your advice for all the young changemakers that are listening to us today. So, as a first question, I would like to ask you, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you start your environmental activism?
Absolutely, Megan. I mean, so it's a very long story, I would say, because I mean, I started out when I was very, very small, but I always wanted to become a veterinarian. And then I realized when I was studying for veterinary school and biology that I would be sort of in only that field or just doing that profession. And I realized I was more into like justice and advocacy and things like that. And that really led me to a path of sort of learning more about environment. And I really love animals. So combining all of it. And then mangroves, which really happened as a tsunami. And that led me to kind of really starting something with my friends. It was very small. We started it off, and then it was a replantation program to stop anything like the tsunami from happening. And all of that combined kind of really skyrocketed over the years to build a social enterprise and to help people understand how important the environment is and to really bring people together as communities, especially Indigenous people, as well as people who are young, who want to voice out, who want to do something, all together as a collective to make a difference.
Thank you, Anoka. And as we heard, there's a lot of initiatives that you have been involved with for a long time. So could you please choose maybe a couple of them or the one that is the most important to you and expand a little bit on that initiative for everyone who is listening to us?
Absolutely. So I think one of the most heartbreaking things for me recently was seeing this very cute puppy dog. He was burned alive just on the 31st night. So it was the 31st of December and people were celebrating the new year. And the dog had been barking and a neighbor had just sort of set him on fire. And that was the most cruel thing that I had ever seen. And it was really heartbreaking. I woke up in tears and I knew that I had to do something because people would generally see something like that and move on the next day, right? So the dog's name was Charlie. And so I wanted to bring justice for Charlie and any other dog who goes through such cruelty. And then I started a petition. Within 3 days, there was more than 120,000 signatures for it. And then we managed to take it to the lawmakers, to parliament. And because the laws in my country, they're very old. They come down from the British and they have very small fines and literally no jail time for anyone who engages in animal cruelty. So it was really bringing people together and going and advocating for that change. So for me, I think personally, that was really important because unlike people, we can always go out there, protest, stand up for our rights, but animals really can't do it. So it was really important for me to have the ability to do that with an incredible group of people. So, yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing this. And this is also something that I completely understand. I have 4 dogs. So they are my family members, you know. I completely understand that you cannot communicate as we do. And it's not fair that they are treated in such cruel ways, especially considering, you know, how beautiful they are and the fact that they deserve the same opportunities. They deserve respect regardless of being different from us. So, I mean, from the bottom of my heart, you know, coming from someone who literally has 4 dogs at home, thank you for stepping up and raising your voice. So that's very valuable and very important. But moving on a little bit, you know, delving into these experiences that you have shared with us and looking back to your journey as an activist and as a social entrepreneur, what do you consider your greatest achievements?
Wow, that's a really great question, Megan. And I think for me, I would say achieving in terms of what the community has achieved is the most important thing. And really, like when we started out, we had no clue about how to work with communities in the sense that we were just kids, right? And then to kind of learning what the communities needed and kind of like really having those dialogues, those are very important, and kind of understanding what their needs were in terms of education, digital skilling, all of those, and kind of making sure that the social enterprise that we did is pretty much providing all of those opportunities to people and continues to provide it, is self-funded and continues to empower people even now to date. I think that's I think one of the biggest achievements for us, honestly, because now you see kids who've kind of gone through our programs, who are doing really well, who are part of local councils, who are advocating for rights, who've gone to different countries and are making a difference. So it's really amazing to see that.
And it is very sustainable because you're teaching something to someone and then this person can replicate that and you see how it grows into people. So, and not only into people, but then the effects in the environment and in the community. So I agree with you. It's super valuable. And thank you for sharing this with us. I know that also something very important from your activism is regarding mangroves. You mentioned that in your introduction when you were telling us about your environmental activism. I know this is very important for you, but unfortunately, not a lot of people know what mangroves are. Maybe somebody who is listening to us right now still has questions of what that means. So could you please explain to us what is the importance of mangroves and what is the vital role that they play to achieving sustainable development and combating climate change?
Oh my gosh. I mean, you're so right, Megan, because I mean, I used to go out there and talk to people about mangroves and people used to ask me, is it mango? Like, why are you so into mangoes, you know? So, I mean, they sound the same, right, when you sometimes say it. So, for me, I think it was really important, like you said, to help people understand that mangoes and mangroves are completely different species. So mangroves grow mostly in salty areas, in lagoons, near the ocean, and they need a certain level of salinity in the water. And there are so many different varieties of mangroves, from Bulgaria, if you want to be really nerdy about the scientific facts, to Sonorasia. So there are different species. And you also have species that are associate mangroves. And they grow sometimes very close to the water and sometimes not so close to the water, but they form a part of the mangrove forest. And it's really amazing to see it because some of these trees, they produce fruits that you can actually eat and make products out of as well. So, and they are an incredible ecosystem for so much of biodiversity, from fish to prawns to birds. You have so many incredible birds that come to mangrove forests across the world. So that's one of the really important things if you think about it from a very environmental and sustainable point of view. And then they're also carbon sequesters. They take a lot of carbon from the air and they store it down in their roots. And it's so important because right now, as you know, across the world, so many people are having heat waves. Even I'm sweating so much right now because it's really warm. And I know a lot of people, some of my friends in Greece were telling me that half of it is on fire. So given the current climate change situations and all of it, mangroves play a huge role in sequestering carbon. And also in the food chain, because it really helps to provide shelter for a lot of the seafood that people eat. And it even is a part of our forests in a way that it helps a lot of biodiversity and cleans up the water. So there are so many really like amazing uses that you get from mangroves, if you look at it from a point of how it helps us and how it helps the environment too. So yeah, I think mangroves are really incredible. So yeah, those are some of the ways that mangroves really help us.
Thank you. They are incredible. And I'm also very glad that you clarified that mangroves and mangoes are different things. I didn't really think about how similar the words are until you mentioned it. And I'm very glad that we get to understand a little bit more. I wish one day, not very far from today, as quickly as people recognize what a mango is, everyone can recognize what a mangrove is and how important they are. You mentioned it has a lot of functions, right? From food, from the environment, from sequestering carbon. So it's very important. And we need to know this in order to make the change and accelerate the change that we need towards 2030. But you are already accelerating it in many ways. And I know that you have replanted over 40,000 mangroves to sustain livelihoods and improve the environment, which is just impressive. And, you know, like many young people are listening to us and also me, I have this genuine question. How did you accomplish this? How can you replant over 40,000 mangroves. How do you do it? Can you please tell us a little bit more about this process?
Absolutely, Megan. So, I mean, it wasn't done overnight, that I can guarantee, because if you try planting mangroves overnight, then you can't really tend to it. There are so many complications that arise, because I've seen some mangrove plantations where people just dig holes very close to each other and they dump a plant in and they think that it's going to grow really well. It doesn't happen. So that's one of the problems that we have sometimes when we try to educate people about it as well. But so it was done over a couple of years. We have our own plant nurseries. We work with communities to bring up seedlings. We bring the seedlings together. We do our own plant nurseries. And we also know that there's a failure rate for mangroves. And then something we really did was we partnered with communities. We partnered with different organizations, in the sense that you get very small societies across Asia. They're like small communities, community-made societies. And partnering with them, giving them that information, doing a lot of knowledge and sort of technical transfers with them and helping them understand how important it was, especially with the village elders, you know, and the religious leaders as well. So kind of having those really kind of like not tough conversations, but being kids, you always don't get taken very serious, right? So it's kind of really facilitating those dialogues and conversations and kind of spreading the word, so that people sometimes came to us saying, hey, how can we do this? So it really took a lot of effort from the start, but then it kind of snowballed by itself as well, to the extent where we expanded into other countries and all of that. So that really happened with partnerships and collaborations, really. So I think we've been very, very blessed in many ways. So I'm grateful for all of that. But yes, it's a lot of people to people kind of relationships that really helped us get here.
Definitely. And also, as you mentioned, approaching the strategic people in the community is also very important. So that also requires a lot of skills. I can tell that you can read the communities and read people very well. But yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you for sharing this with us. Because definitely, as I mentioned, you know, replanting that amount is incredible and not very easy to achieve. So thank you for clarifying this. And yeah, just letting everyone know, everyone who's listening, you know, even if something sounds very hard, you can make it, right? Like in this case. When you read it, you hear it, it sounds pretty much impossible, but it's not. But yeah, I just wanted to highlight that for everyone who's listening to us and maybe thinks, I cannot do it, you can. And Anoka is a perfect example. So moving a little bit into the topic of legislation, because, you know, speaking about the protection of mangroves, we have been touching this into many perspectives. We're planting it, communicating its importance, but also legislation is crucial. It is crucial to protect the environment and to protect mangroves. So could you please share a little bit more about the importance of legislation?
Absolutely, Megan. I mean, really great question again. Legislation is really important because it helps you protect them in the long run. Even if, you know, like, for example, if something happens to me tomorrow and there's nobody to speak about mangroves, the legislation would always be there to protect it, right? So it's so important to kind of advocate for it and stand up for it. And what we did was we worked with a lot of people from the ground, from the grassroots communities, all of them. We brought everyone together and we kind of really managed to advocate and pressure the government, and to the extent where the president gave a declaration called a gazette, saying that the mangroves are protected species. And that was in 2019, and that was so helpful for us, because every time we saw someone harming it, cutting it down, whatever, or we also kind of like work with a bit of vigilante type groups across the country and everywhere, where people take footage of things that people are doing wrong, like cutting down mangroves, and they send it to us, and we can always prosecute them, or we can go for like an environmental justice case against them, because of that legislation. So it's really important to have that, because then the law supports you, and it's so much easier to kind of walk into a court and be like, hey, you're doing this wrong thing, and the law says you're doing it wrong too, and the law is on our side. So you either gotta like plant a lot more mangroves, or you gotta like really help or support communities who are protecting them with support that'll help them do it for longer. So yeah, legislation is extremely important. Great question, Megan.
No, great answer. Thank you. That's true. Like, legislation is crucial, because otherwise it can't be possible that you're doing this effort, but there's nothing to back it up. And I think, which is something very important about your activism, is that you are doing it very sustainable. Like, you make it very not centered on one person, and if that one person is not here, everything is over. But you find ways to make it last forever, or make it, as I was saying, sustainable. The fact that if maybe one person unfortunately cannot keep communicating about the importance of mangroves, then there's already a law to back it up. And, you know, people can act as, you know, citizens, police, or, you know, take action. And there's something to back it up. So thank you for delving into this. It's also very, very important. And I was wondering, you have been, you know, in the topic of protecting mangroves for a long time, and there's been a lot of achievements through this time. But what do you believe nowadays is the biggest gap in mangrove conservation in Asia? Maybe in your country or in Asia in general? I know it's a bit broad, but yeah, given your expertise, I was wondering, what do you think is that thing that mangrove protection hasn't achieved much attention today compared to other environmental aspects?
So I think this is an actual issue, not just in Asia, but even in areas that have mangroves across the African region, Latin America, all of it, even in the Caribbeans. And that is, a lot of people do try to have mangrove plantations because it's a bit of a hot topic right now, especially with sort of the blue-green strategy and all of it. But a lot of them really lack the expertise in planting it. And I think I touched on it a little bit before as well, because you have this mass scale planting, sometimes 1 million plants in a day or 1,000 plants in a day. And people really miss out on the part that you do need to care for mangroves after planting them for a little bit of time until they grow to a certain height. And even then, you do have a failure rate of about 10%, give or take, depending on the area and the species that you plant, because you do need to do a lot of analysis on what you're planting as well. So there is quite a bit of a scientific gap, I would say, and also in terms of landscape restoration and replantation. So there's a bit of a gap, because you can study about mangroves, but if you don't do the work, you won't necessarily know how to do it in real life out there in the wild. So I've seen this happen a few times, and there's so many resources and ways to kind of speak to someone or get that information and avoid that, because there's so much of resources that really go into it, right, in terms of money and effort and time. So it's always best to kind of really make that effort to do it the right way around, and maybe plant less or plant as many as you can take care of, or get more people involved. So yeah, I think that's definitely a challenge with mangroves.
And it's a very important point that you're touching, because if we're going to do something, it's better if we do it well, if we do it informed, because I think it is possible that sometimes, and we have seen it as well in other countries, that maybe politicians or other organizations would say, like, we're going to plant a certain amount of trees in this case, or a certain amount of any other species. And it's not only about planting, it's about, you know, making sure that the right amount is planted, that it is properly maintained afterwards. And I think that is something very important, because although it's good, we're not saying don't plant, of course not. It's important and it's good and it's a great step, but we need to do it correctly. We need to do it being informed. And at the same time, we need to ensure that it's not only one day action. As you just pretty well just mentioned it, maintenance is very important. So thank you so much for this. I think it's a very, very valuable point. And we're going to translate a little bit more about COP, because as you mentioned at the beginning, before we started this call, Anouk and I were just talking a little bit about COP coming, and something very exciting happened during the previous COP. So during COP27, an exciting event took place related to this topic we're talking about. So it was the launch of the Mangrove Alliance for Climate. I think it's possible that this event happened, but not many people are very familiar about what it is and what it encompasses. So could you please provide a little bit more details about it, and at the same time share your opinion on it? Do you think it's enough? Do you think policymakers should prioritize a particular aspect of it for the upcoming COP?
Again, really amazing questions, Megan. And I do think the Mangrove Alliance is a good idea because it kind of helps people have a lot more connectivity with their work and kind of understand the challenges you go through as well, because most of these are very similar to what people go through in their own country. And that really helps people to feel like you have someone in your corner who knows a lot about the same thing, right? So it's a great initiative, really. In my opinion, though, like with the current situation the world is facing, we do need a lot more sort of support. If you've been following COP, you would know that there is a lot of money that was kind of allocated for support to countries who are facing a lot of climate issues and vulnerabilities, and that money that was pledged hasn't really translated into actual deposits as well. So there is a lot of support that's needed in terms of the loss and damage fund, in terms of more support for actual climate adaptation. And even when it comes to things like solar or mangrove replantation or even social enterprises that can support communities, there hasn't been a lot of support in terms of sort of driving communities to kind of own these or communities to really implement this. Because at the end of the day, you can start anything at a high level, but if it's not translated to the grassroots where it's really needed, then you don't really have a lot of change happening. And I think we've seen this happen throughout the history of COP. And I think it's really important for action to really happen more than the talking, to be very honest.
Thank you so much for sharing this. And I think everyone that is listening would agree. Action is very important. And unfortunately, sometimes it's a little bit hard because these conversations are at a very high level. But we have seen that throughout the years, COP has been a little bit more inclusive in, you know, at having activists joining. And then I think this is also something that has had a lot of struggles. But at the same time, having more voices and more diversity and thinking about it in a more diverse way that encompasses more actors is crucial to accelerate this point and to make it more into grassroots and into action. And, you know, everything that is discussed there, the results in a way are going to have an impact. But as you pretty well mentioned it, we need to make sure that it, you know, it goes into concrete action. So, and by the way, like in your intervention, you talked about social entrepreneurship. And that's really good because we're going to delve into it right now. Could you tell us a little bit more about your experience in social entrepreneurship and its relationship with protection of the environment? I know that you have had a relationship with a project named Growing Money. Could you please share with us a little bit more about it?
Sure, absolutely, Megan. So when you talk about Growing Money, it's a mangrove-based social enterprise, and it's based a lot on kind of replanting mangroves, but at the same time having an income stream for the communities who plant them. So we've really worked on different types and streams of income, and they range from community to community because we understood what the communities can provide and what they need as well. And this is where those community dialogues really come into play. And some communities needed digital skills, some preferred to just use ecotourism as an additional source of income. Some really wanted to get into beekeeping. So all of these aspects we brought together with the mangroves because a lot of them do live around the mangroves. Some of them are fishermen, some of them are agricultural people who work a lot with organic farms. And a lot of people actually transitioned from having farms which used a lot of chemical fertilizer into using more organic fertilizer because of us talking to them, and they understood that the fertilizer could actually end up in the water and get into the fish that they were eating as well. It's been an interesting kind of, I would say, change that has come about when people realized the effects that chemicals could have on their own body. Even things like chronic kidney disease can come from some fertilizers. So understanding the health implications and then really building social enterprises around the mangroves helped us to kind of sustain it and make it very sustainable and long-term, really, and give ownership back to the community because, you know, they're the ones who need it the most and they're the ones who actually live there.
Definitely. And I'm very curious to know, when did you start this initiative? For how long has it been operating? And at the same time, since I'm already asking this question, it sounds now wonderful, but I was wondering, were there challenges that you faced building this social enterprise, and which were they?
Absolutely. Again, really great questions, Megan. And I would say we started it more than 10 years ago. We, like I said, we were extremely small and very inexperienced in social enterprise. We didn't even understand what it was until we really understood the concepts of it. For us, it was just making sure the mangroves grew and that the people were happy. So very simple things that we wanted to achieve when we set out. But I think for us, the social enterprise aspect really came in because we used to go and talk to a lot of people in the communities, and they would say like, hey, you know, we don't really have the time to be planting stuff. We have to go fish. We have farms to look after. I have kids back home. Are you insane to ask me to just come and plant stuff? What do I get out of it? Like, those were the actual questions we had. And that's when we went back to the drawing board and we were thinking, how do we make people want to be a part of this? Because, I mean, we were kids, so we had time and we lived with our parents, so we didn't have a lot of costs. But if you were somebody who was living in a community and your entire family depended on you, how would you make it work, right? So that's where the whole, we got to find a way to get, you know, an increase of income for these people so that then there would be a better way of kind of protecting the mangroves and getting people involved as well, long term. So that's how it really happened. And challenges, yeah, oh my gosh, so many really. In terms of, I mean, I think I told you, like, the way the people questioned us initially, it's like, oh, you guys are kids, you have no idea about the real world, you don't understand the challenges we go through, the trouble I have raising my 5 kids, I won't be able to feed them if I don't get extra income. So all of those things did come up, even in terms of the mangroves, understanding how it worked, the failure rates, the growth, the maintenance, and some of it is, it can be quite expensive if you don't have a lot of people involved, because if you are trying to pay someone to go and do the maintenance, it's very expensive. Whereas if the community is doing it, they're doing it because they get an extra income anyway from ecotourism or selling of some of the fruits and the supplies. So yes, it was creating that balance and really understanding it as a business module without ever going to business school at that stage, and kind of really understanding that and incorporating all of that. Yeah, so it was not easy. Even when you were expanding into areas, kind of explaining what mangroves were to people, just like the question you asked. So we had to do a lot of knowledge sharing, a lot of understanding, a lot of, I would say a lot of storytelling and letting people really understand the value of mangroves as well. So yeah, it was a lot of work.
Definitely, it was a lot of work and a lot of effort, but it worked out pretty well. And thank you so much for answering these questions, because as I was saying, you know, and I'm asking these questions because as young people are listening to us, they might be wondering, you know, it sounds amazing, but how do I do it? Or was it easy to start? Or, you know, and I think it's important for them to know that the road is not going to be as simple, but there's going to be challenges that you can overcome. I think this is a perfect example of resilience and of motivation. And, you know, you have the spirit of an activist. Just as you said, you know, we had no education on business. Like, we didn't go to business school, but you research on your own, and you did it with your community, with the people that were helping you. And you didn't get discouraged, even if people were telling you that you were a kid, that you didn't know what you were doing. And that is something very important. And it talks to me about the importance of resilience for young activists and young social entrepreneurs. And definitely it's not an easy path, because even if, you know, people who advocate for these issues get questioned, if you advocate for these issues as someone young or as a kid, you're going to get double the questions. And you have to be prepared. You have to expect that is a reality, unfortunately. But at the same time, as we have talked about it through the podcast, knowledge and you having, you know, the opportunity to communicate that knowledge with other people is a life changer, and it's going to be very helpful in this journey. So thank you. Thank you again for sharing this, Anoka. It's very valuable.
Thank you so much for the really great questions, Megan.
No problem. And, you know, as we have been talking about your experience throughout the years, and now we talked about as well the challenges. And I was just wondering, in your experience as an activist and as a social entrepreneur, what is it that has made you continue even when there's these challenges, you know, when everything seems like it's not working or whenever you have people telling you you don't know what you're doing? What is it that kept you, you know, interested? What is it that kept you motivated throughout the years?
So I think a few things. One thing is, for example, with animal welfare, I kept seeing Charlie's face in my dreams. For me, it was so important because I know there were so many other dogs who were being harassed, beaten, all of that. So for me, I think I have dogs as well, so I know how it feels. And for me, it was important to keep fighting for that. As for mangroves and the rest of the social enterprise and other work, I think the fact that people kind of really benefit from it and they keep coming back and now people ask us to support them or help them or how they can do it or run something like this, I think that's really motivating for me as a person. And I know that having an incredible team has also helped in terms of really keep, you know, that you keep motivated, you keep going because you have these great people around you who keep supporting you as well. And like even through whatever challenges that come, you kind of sit down, you have a cup of tea or you brainstorm or you really kind of like work together. So it's been really good in that sense. Yeah.
Thank you so much for answering these. And actually, you know, since I we're already in a very inspirational tone, I would like to delve into some questions for the young change makers that are listening to us. For young people, that have already started their environmental activism or that haven't, but they want to, what is it something that they can do, maybe from their home or in a way that is not very hard to begin in order to protect mangroves?
You can do so much, really. I mean, if you use your social media as a voice to speak out about mangroves or even other environmental issues that you care about, be it animal welfare, anything really, you can use your voice. And social media has given such amazing platforms really across from TikTok to Instagram to whatever you use. You can always do so much with it. And you can get very creative in a way that you kind of really motivate others as well, right? So I do think social media is a great tool for that. But beyond that, you can always kind of bring people together to sign online petitions, kind of advocate online, even do things like citizen sort of policing, things like that, that you can really kind of start off even at a small scale in your community or something like that. And that really helps, you know, sort of focus on one environmental issue or challenge that you can solve or try to solve with and bring people together. Because a lot of people love to come together to support a cause. And there are so many people across the world who'd love to do that as well. So it's really great to connect with people, like even with global change makers. I have friends that I've made who remain lifelong friends who still support our work. So, you know, things like that really help you kind of keep going on and bring people together for sort of partnerships, collaborations across borders, just from your own home. And that's that. And that's what makes everything so incredible.
Definitely, you can make a change. And I think you touch a very important point, and it's the fact that many young people have access to technology, and many people from this generation has, in a way, grew with technology, and they know how to use it in ways that are not as practical or that other generations struggle a little bit more. So I think it is a very important advice, and yeah, definitely agree with it. I wanted to delve into a topic, if you feel comfortable, because I think it's helpful for young people to know about this. I know that you personally have used social media to bring change, and you did it about a case of harassment in your country. If you feel comfortable and you want to talk about it, could you please share with the audience, how is it that you use social media in this precise scenario to bring change?
Absolutely. I mean, really amazing question, Megan. For me, I was actually going to a meeting that day, and this person who was driving a tuk-tuk, a tuk-tuk is a small vehicle that a lot of people use in South Asia and some parts of East Asia as well. I'm not sure if it's there in other countries, so forgive my sort of ignorance on that. But yeah, this guy just started following me and started to harass me. And for some reason that day, I mean, I always have my phone with me, but I just kind of had enough because I had heard about a case where a girl got killed after being harassed by somebody because she had turned him down when he wanted to date her. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? You have the right to say no. And I mean, this guy should have gotten the sort of idea that I was not interested because I was, you know, driving and minding my own business. And for me, I think something really like exploded within me at that moment. I was like, you know, I'm just going to take a video of this because I really need to make sure that I complain to the police with evidence. And to be very honest, that was the first time I had been to the police to make a complaint of that sort. And I took the video, I went to the cops and I sort of made that complaint and I took it to courts because what people try to do is they try to kind of take it away so that it's easier for them to get away with it and continue to get away with it. But then it went to courts and it kind of became a part of law because law has this thing called law of precedent, which I think a lot of people are really using now, even with the environment right now. And that makes it a part of law. So if someone else underwent the same thing that I was going through, they don't have to go through the whole process of going to courts. They can cite that and be like, this person did XYZ and this is the actual fine or jail time or everything that they need to go through. So it was, I think I didn't think of all that at the point of time where I was just recording it, because for me, it was just, I had had enough and I don't want other people to go through it. And that was the whole point of me making the complaint. But I think it really, really helped a lot of people come out and speak about their experiences. And a lot of women, not just in my country, in other countries also reached out about the harassment they go through and how now they use their phones to kind of make evidence of the people who are harassing them and using it to make complaints, because there were people who apparently couldn't get things like sort of restraining orders against people. And now phones and technology really has been helping so many women and people who identify as women as well. So it's incredible, I think.
Thank you so much for sharing this. And it's very important to, I wanted to delve into this so that people can know the many uses of technological devices and how is it that they can relate to activism and they can foster changes. We talked about social media, how is it that social media is a tool to communicate, a tool to educate, a tool to create partnerships, but also a tool, not precisely social media, but, you know, the resources that we achieve from technological devices, how is it that they can be evidence and they can lead to changes just as it happened with your own experience? So thank you so much for sharing this. And unfortunately, we are almost in the end of this podcast episode, but we cannot leave today's episode without a very important question that I wanted to ask you for you to share with all young people that are listening. What is it that you would recommend? Or in other words, what advice would you give to all young people that are listening and that hear your story and say, I want to be, you know, a social entrepreneur, or I want to be an environmental activist? What advice would you give to them?
So I would say do what makes you the happiest. And what kind of, you know, makes you wake up in the morning thinking, you know, I'm living my life the way I want to. I think that's really important, especially when it comes to mental health. I know a lot of people are going through a lot as well. So it's so important to really understand what you're fighting for and to kind of really embrace it in a way that is healthy for you and is also really important for you as a person, is aligned with your values, and to kind of really fight for it with people who care about it as well. So yes, find your tribe, find your people. I know Global Changemakers has been like an incredible tribe for me, but find your tribe and keep fighting. And you know, that's what I can say. And don't give up, even if results take a bit of time. Know that you will reach your goal. It will happen.
Thank you very much, Anoka. It is very important, everything that you share with us. I don't have words to describe how much I admire everything that you have done. And I'm very grateful that you shared this advice with all the young people that are listening to us. So find your tribe, do what you love, and don't give up. One more time, thank you so much, Anoka. It's been a pleasure having you in the Young Changemakers podcast. And keep fighting.
Thank you so much, Megan. And you keep fighting too.